in this episode.
And I was mad at Glinda from that point forward. And the very idea that we are supposed to acknowledge that this is a good entity. This is what good entities will do. This is what happens when you trust someone. She's going to send you down a yellow brick road where you're going to get harassed and possibly killed, and you're going to meet a bunch of weirdos. Well, hello there. I'm Cool Gray, and this is Cool Gray in Studio A. Welcome back to the podcast. We're in episode 16 today. I have just a little bit of business to conduct with you today, and then I promise you we are going to get right to the conversation, which today is with my guest Kirsten Petras, and we are talking about dystopia in film and literature. We are going to name drop all of your favorite books and movies, no matter what genre you like to read in. You're going to hear about stuff that you know and love. As far as the business goes, just want to say, if you're joining me, and I know we have several new subscribers and visitors just since the last couple of episodes, so I want to welcome you on board. If you're coming back for a second dip into this pot, I'm super grateful. I would love to encourage you to continue to subscribe, listen, watch. If you're listening and you prefer the video version, check out the YouTube channel. Cool Gray in Studio A is available every single episode in full video content. So join me over there. In fact, I'm going to make it official by issuing a listener challenge to you. If you are listening for the first time or the second time, or possibly even the third time, I want to challenge you to go and take a look at another episode. Find one, I challenge you, that is about a subject you didn't think you might be interested in, or a guest that you've never heard of, and expose yourself to something new, because that's what we're all about around here, is getting you to exercise your brain and work your mind and introduce you to people that you would not otherwise meet and have interesting experiences listening to the conversations that we have. Every single one of them has been an experience to remember for me. And so I'm confident that that will overflow onto you. And I just want to invite you to do that. And if you do, please let me know by commenting either where you listen, where you watch, find me on social media, especially the Facebook page, or on Instagram or TikTok, and let me know what your experience is. Please do that, because next episode coming up in 2 weeks with Kathleen Martin of MUFON fame will be the last episode in season 2. And then we're going to take a little hiatus while I actually take a real hiatus and go on vacation. And then we're going to come back with season 3 around the 22nd of June. So between now and then, you have a little time to catch up on some past episodes. And I really want to encourage you to do so. Okay, without further delay, let's get right to today's guest. I'd like to introduce my guest today. Kirsten Petras is a Brooklyn-based fiction author, but she primarily identifies as caffeine in a human suit held together by hairspray and sheer force of will. She's been published in Punk Noir, Hoosier Noir, Alien Buddha Press, City Lights Theater Company, and A Thin Slice of Anxiety. Her debut novel, The Next Witness, was released in May 2022 by Cinnabar Moth Publishing. When Kirsten's not writing, she trains contortion and aerial hoop, and she is also the co-host of Dark Waters, a literary podcast exploring all that is dark, dreary, and wonderfully twisted. And that is what we are going to talk about today. Kirsten, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me. I love the way that you said that last line. That was great.
Oh, I'm just a frustrated actress at heart, I guess. I love the whole caffeine in a human suit held together by hairspray and sheer force of will.
You know, I got that from there's a comedian called Christopher Titus, who I first watched him probably at an age I should not have watched him. And he had this whole joke about like being a terrible human underneath like a candy coated layer or something like that. And I was like, I want to do something with that style of joke. And once I figured that out, I just never changed my bio because it works. It works and I'm keeping it.
Yeah. When it works, you hold on to it. Let's just start with a little bit of background information about who you are and how come this is an area of specialty and great interest for you.
I did my undergraduate in international relations at the University of Edinburgh, and then I went on to do my master's in global affairs at NYU. But I think my real kind of focus on politics and foreign policy really started when I was in high school, and I did junior State of America summer school 2 summers in a row, because if that all didn't tell you that I'm a massive nerd, hi, I'm a massive nerd. And I willingly 2 summers in a row did these like 3-week courses that ended with a 12 to 15 page term paper. And we were at Georgetown and we were going to all these different agencies. And I ended up starting a junior State of America chapter at my high school. And then I started to take AP US History. And I think for a lot of American students, they don't get necessarily like a fuller picture of what early American history looked like until they're in late high school, which, mm-hmm. you know, makes sense content wise. And I was just getting so frustrated that I started writing what became a very early draft of my book, because I was just like, I need to take my angst out on Madison's politics, like out on something. And yeah, that kind of turned into, and I'd like kind of been writing stories since I was a kid. My mom writes children's literature. I do not. And then I just throughout college and throughout grad school just started, like, kept developing that story, started writing short stories, and here we are now.
And I would just like to point out that you are under the age of 30, if I recall correctly.
Yes, I turned 29 in December.
It not only makes you a nerd, it makes you a massive overachiever and also restores my faith in humanity. So I'm glad you exist and that
you're
in the world. In particular, since you're saying you're studying global affairs and world politics, is that what sparked the interest in, we're going to be talking about dystopia today, mm-hmm. Which is usually born out of something that's going on politically in a given culture that tends to be the catalyst for a lot of authors. So did those things go hand in hand for you? Did one precede the other? Did they happen completely separately from one another?
You know, I think they really did happen in tandem, because while I was kind of learning more and more about how the society that I was in was functioning, and also just feeling like, because this was when I was in high school during the Great Recession, I was going into college with the idea of zero job prospects. I graduated from a MS in global affairs while the State Department and Foreign Service officers, like all that was being gutted. So it was just kind of this ongoing frustration of just like, what am I supposed to be doing within this society after having done everything that I was told to do? I was told, right, go to a better high school so that you can go to a better college, so that you can go to grad school, so that you can do something with your life. And I was like, cool, I checked off all these boxes. What is this that I've been promised? And I keep being told like, it's coming kind of thing. So it was kind of that frustration, which I think a lot of people in my generation can really identify with. But it's also, while I was writing the story, I wrote like the first very early, terrible, terrible draft of this book when I was 15, just about to turn 16. So the characters in the book really grew up with me. And I think I really learned how to write this story over and over and over again. So it was a combination of being very intimately familiar of how someone frustrated in the world in which they live will operate, while also studying the mechanics of world politics.
Wow. Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit more about the book later on, but that's a fascinating trajectory that put you in a great position to develop your characters while you were developing and while the world was changing before your very eyes. Which is a theme that we see very often in this genre. So since we're talking about dystopia, let's define the terms first for the listening audience who may or may not be as nerdy as we are in this area. And while we're probably equally nerdy about the subject, we are a couple of generations apart. So the experiences that we've had with the literature and with the film in this genre doesn't necessarily intersect. I know you're going to leave me in the dust when we get past like the late 1980s, when I kind of unplugged from the literature field. So you'll be able to pick it up from there. But I found a website. It's called Studio Binder, which seems to be a website that helps screenwriters and directors find their way in the world of film. And they've defined the terms for me. And actually, the word Utopia was first coined by an author named Sir Thomas More. And in 1516, he wrote a book called Utopia, and that was derived from the Greek words that literally mean no place, meaning here's a presentation of an ideal that doesn't exist and cannot exist. So from there, later on, the dystopian genre kind of grew out of that, which is basically all things bad that can happen. And the definition that they give on this website is the dystopian genre imagines worlds or societies where life is extremely bad because of deprivation or oppression or terror. And human society is characterized by misery such as squalor, oppression, disease, overcrowding, environmental destruction, or war. So, you know, anything that can go wrong will. And it can come out of trying to create a utopia, which when that term was formed, by the very definition of the word, says here's something that can't exist. And if you try, dystopian culture says it's not going to go well at all.
So,
what do you think of that definition?
I think that that's a really accurate way of putting it. And I think it's so interesting because you see these stories that even if they are utopian, usually there's something that goes wrong or the utopia is destroyed. It's kind of this idea of even if you can sort of achieve it, there's something off about it. And also utopian is so interesting to me because just given the world and how many, like all the different cultures, all the different ways that people live, different religions, different customs, different whatever, how do you define what is utopian?
Yeah. What's utopia for me may not look anything like what utopia looks like for you. That's a huge point.
Yeah. My utopia is a giant library, a giant leather couch, and an endless supply of whiskey and no demands whatsoever. That's my utopia. I don't think I could say that's true of everybody, right? But
I prefer Bailey's Irish Cream to whiskey. So right there we're going to have to part ways.
So one of the first books I read kind of in the genre was Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. And he also wrote Island. And it's very interesting because Brave New World is a book about repression, kind of, it's meant to be this utopian society. And then you have an outsider come in being like, this is not okay. What are you talking about? And on the utopian side with Island, you have this guy who enters this world seeking to destroy it, more or less. And he's looking at all these things and kind of appreciating the world in which it exists. And sorry, spoiler alert for a 50-year-old book. It ends poorly. It ends exactly how the book should, but it doesn't end well for the people in that society. And it's interesting because he presented one as a dystopian, one as a utopian, but at the end of the day, neither is okay. So I think people are more drawn to this idea of a dystopian story because humans being repressed, humans being backed into corners, humans reacting in different ways when they feel like they have no options is a story that's much more relatable than, and the sun shines every day and we never have to work and we never have to do this and like, or whatever people define as a utopian story.
Yeah, even for those of us of my generation who grew up on Disney princesses, and Disney seems to, on the surface, present us with these magical environments. We grow up with this kind of romanticized ideas about princesses and castles, but there are also, you know, evil queens and poison apples and mermaids who can't walk or lose their voices. There's all kinds of dark stuff going on that somehow we don't realize until we grow up and look back on it. I remember because it wasn't that long ago, I had a friend whose daughter was crazy about Frozen when it was, you know, every little girl in the world was crazy about Frozen. And because I don't have children, I wasn't plugged into it at all. And my friend said to me, what do you mean you've never seen Frozen? You need to come over to the house. We'll have a Frozen party. And I'm like, do we need to?
Oh, wow.
I mean, are we not grown? But she was so genuine about her desire to share this experience with me. I said, all right, I'll show up. And it was me and her daughter, a couple of her daughter's friends, and a couple of neighbors. And she put out all these themed decorations and fairy lights all over the place and made food that was in the colors of Ella's dress and all of this kind of stuff.
Oh, wow.
And so I sat and sat down and watched this movie. And as I'm watching the movie, I realized that I was horrified by the message that I was getting out of this film. When they're singing "Let It Go," they're not talking about getting rid of your anxiety. They're talking about a potentially lethal ability that this central character has, that she's tired of containing. And they're basically, the song is about her unleashing this horror upon the world without any regard for what's going to happen as a result. And and our kids are running around singing let it go," like it's, we're teaching them to unleash their fury unchecked on the world. And nobody seemed to realize it. I didn't know what to do with that. And I had to smile and eat the cupcakes and pretend everything was okay.
Yeah, that's such an interesting way. I never viewed that song in that way, but because I was looking at it through the context of these two sisters, mostly the one sister, right, that has experienced such emotional repression and experienced such emotional trauma and really just needed therapy of being like, listen, you have this power. We're going to teach. There are clearly people in this universe that could teach her how to use it. And they're like, and even it's to me, it was so like, I didn't feel, this is going to sound so bad, I didn't feel bad when the parents died, because it's a Disney movie, you know the parents are going to die, but when she has that first moment, and she like hits Anna with ice, and then they go to the trolls, and the trolls are like, teach her how to use it, and they're like, never use it, you can never use it, constantly be afraid of yourself. Like, yeah, of course she's going to have an evil queen moment of just like,
yeah, here we go.
All of the emotion all at once. Here you go. I'm still afraid of myself.
That's what the song is advocating. Just let it all go, girl. Let that freak flag fly and don't worry about the consequences.
Oh, jeez.
And, you know, leave it to me. Maybe I just have this dystopian bent in me. This, for me, seeing it from an angle that nobody else seems to see it from, goes back to The Wizard of Oz for me growing up, which came back before the days, you're never going to remember this. There was a time, Kirsten, when DVRs didn't exist.
I watched Wizard of Oz on VHS, I would like to say.
Before VHS even existed, it would come on broadcast television in March every year. And we would look at a TV guide. It was a little book with newsprint that had all the listings in it. And I would have to go and sit in front of my television on that day at that time to watch it every year. So it was an event because you couldn't just record it and watch it on demand. So that was my fairy tale for the day. And I would watch it every year. And I wasn't maybe more than 16 when it occurred to me how Dorothy had been done so dirty, because here comes this woman in a bubble with a big dress. She introduces herself and says, I am Glinda, the good witch of the North, and asks her, are you a good witch or a bad witch? So she sets up the parameters right there. But then what does she do? She sends her on this ridiculous, dangerous journey. She has to go kill a bad witch. She has to go do all this horrible stuff. Then she has to meet a wizard who's not a wizard. And then at the very end, when the wizard can't help her, Glinda shows up in her bubble and her big dress again and says what to her? You had the power to go home all along.
I could have told you this 2 hours ago, but that would have been, I needed
what
you to do that
hell,
anywhere.
Glinda? What kind of a good witch? And I was mad at Glinda from that point forward. And the very idea that we are supposed to acknowledge that this is a good entity. This is what good entities will do. This is what happens when you trust someone. She's going to send you down a yellow brick road where you're going to get harassed and possibly killed. And you're going to meet a bunch of weirdos who are flawed in a bunch of ways. And then you're going to seek out help from someone who Glinda knew all along was really not capable of
helping
her.
Not going to help. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it's a dream. So I don't even know why it was a dream. But
do you know the origins of that story?
Tell me. Do you?
Yeah. So one based off, sorry, just on what you were saying, I always was like, and I'm very close to my sister. My sister's my best friend. If someone dropped a house on my sister, I would absolutely be after blood. Like, I don't care if I turn green like that. That's not okay. You killed her sister. Like, just no, I don't know. Anyway. Even if accidentally, we can sort that out, like in a court system, but like, you know,
somebody has to pay.
Someone's got to pay. But the actual origins of that story, it was not a, so the original was written by, I don't remember who wrote it, but it was about the gold standard. It was not that she had ruby shoes, she had silver shoes. And it was the Cowardly Lion was William Jennings Bryan, who was a guy who did this whole cross of gold speech, had two failed presidential whatever. But the whole thing was an allegory for getting America off the gold standard. It had nothing to do with witches or whatever, which I think is why some of those themes get a little bit weird in the movie translation. And like, I watched that movie as a kid. I liked it as a kid, found some things weird as a kid, but it makes a lot more sense when you're looking at the story being like, oh, this was about money the whole time. This was never about like internal journeys or whatever. Because at the end, she's like, I want to go somewhere. And then she wakes up and she's still in Grayscale, Kansas. Like, it's not, I don't find that a happy ending that you just are content now to be in Grayscale, Kansas. But yeah, the whole thing was was about the gold standard.
Didn't she get knocked on the head in the twister, and that's how she had this dream? It wasn't like Annie M. fed her some bad muffins or something.
No, it was a tornado induced concussion.
Yeah, concussion dreams. There's a whole genre.
Whole genre right there.
Fantastic. I think I had heard something about the ruby slippers having been silver at some point, but I did not know that. So thank you for that. And dystopian, when you're talking about thinking that something is like Oz looks like this fantastic place, but it isn't. It's certainly both Kansas and Oz are dystopian. Even though, you know, a little farm girl in Kansas getting to play with the animals all day and having this lovely little idyllic farm life. But there was Miss Gulch that was bothering her all the time. And then in Oz, where you've got color, technicolor, and you've got women in bubbles and big dresses that seem to be good, but are not.
Yeah. And magic and people who will just like give you a little dance and give you candy. And then
Lollipop Guild.
Yeah. Then you start skipping down a yellow brick road and trees start throwing apples at you, you know, as trees do.
I'll show you how to get apples. The Scarecrow was absolutely my favorite for sure. Let's grow up a little bit and get back to literature for a minute. I started reading science fiction when I was in my early teens, and then spent about a decade living at science fiction conventions that I would go to all over the world. And I got taken under the wing by some of my favorite authors of the era of the early 80s, and trying to develop myself as a writer as well, and sitting through a lot of panel discussions and listening to a lot of conversations about the fiction of the day. But for me, it went all the way back to required reading. You were talking about Brave New World and the Huxley stuff, but there's also the Orwellian stuff. There's the Animal Farm, which was all required reading when I was growing up. 1984, Bradbury, Fahrenheit 451, all things that we were required to read, which I think today, all of those could be on the banned book list for all I know. I don't know what's going on with that, but we seem to be going down a dystopian.
I think they might be. I think all of them might be. I was, my friend's daughter is in eighth grade and was told to read Animal Farm. And I was shocked. Not that this eighth grader was reading Animal Farm, which like, I think she will get much more out of it in a decade, but like good on them for like introducing the material. But that she could read this in a Wisconsin school still. Like that was my moment of like, oh, you can still read that.
There's hope.
Awesome.
Yeah, because there were no elements in there that necessarily obviously undermined whatever the agenda is of the banners. So I was reading all that stuff in high school, and a lot of us were, but I don't think that I wasn't as smart as you at high school age. So I read everything at face value. And unless the teacher was doing a good job at helping us understand what the underlying story was really trying to say and what the messages were, and to get us to really engage our brains and not just consume the way we binge Netflix today, that's kind of how I read the stuff. It's an assignment. I have to read it. I read it and I took it very much at face value because I just didn't know enough about the world to understand the underlying message. And then later looking back, it's like, oh my goodness. Yeah. Wow. Animal Farm wasn't about animals that could talk, was it?
You know what? I think for a lot of it though, is that I have come to appreciate a lot of these books and a lot of these stories more as I've gotten older and gotten more life experience. And I think it's so easy for us as adults to say, well, kids should be reading these things and understanding these things. And I'm like, I didn't understand that stuff when I was in high school. Like I probably had a decent level of understanding enough to like write a paper about it. But if you were going to ask me to like explain the nuances of Animal Farm today, versus the nuances of Animal Farm in ninth grade, it'd be a much different conversation. And I think it's not necessarily that those stories don't have value at that age. It's that I don't think we're giving students the context to understand them, to your point of like, unless you had a teacher that really understood it. I remember reading in high school this horrible book called The Awakening by Kate Chopin. And it was just one of the worst things I've ever read. And I'm probably going to piss someone off by saying that. Kate Chopin fans, I'm sorry, but I'm not. And it was about this woman who just like had no person, from what I remember, had no personality whatsoever, fell in love with a gay man and drowned herself in the sea. That was the book. That was the plot.
How tragically romantic.
It wasn't though. Like, it wasn't actually romantic. And it was basically like we read it at the same time as The Yellow Wallpaper, which is a story about a woman with postpartum depression. And I was like, you could have made us read anything by the Bronte sisters to talk about like repression in that time, and it would have been better than this story. And I feel like we keep forcing kids to read stories like that. And if we could just stop teaching The Great Gatsby, I would be really happy. Like, I just want us to stop insisting on these classics for children when there's been, to your point, like, we must have gone to high school in much, much different years. And I'm not saying that those books still aren't relevant, but why are we teaching the same books however many years later? Why are we teaching those same books to students now? I feel like there's much more recent literature or much even just new ways of teaching it that we're not giving students the context of like, these books relate to the world in ways that like A, B, and C that
and,
you might
and
not.
As well, you're being given these assignments in a literature class or in an English class when actually we need to bring the social studies teachers in to help us make sense of what we're reading. So if we're breaking it down in terms of character development and plot advancement and all of those devices that go along with what makes great literature great, that is one conversation. But if we're talking, and again, all of those books I mentioned, the Huxley books, the Orwell books, the Bradbury books, that was all required high school reading. They were all dystopian. And who is going to help us before we've even launched into the world make sense of all of this literature and what it was meant to convey and what are we supposed to do with it now that we've read it? And I think that crosses departments within a high school. That's one reason why I think we have to look back on it years later after we've had some world experience. But also, you studied in Europe. Mm-hmm. One thing I have found whenever I've talked to Europeans, I've done a little bit of traveling there. It comes home to me over and over again, walking through the streets of Rome, where you'll see, you know, a modern building in the middle of a city street, literally, boom, right next door to some kind of ruin. They live amidst their ancient history. It's right there in front of them. They're immersed in where they've come from. And as a country, we're not only in America too young to have even developed that kind of physical environment, we're too separated from the rest of the world to care about what's going on outside of our little universe. We're America. Like, we don't even know what's going on in Canada and Mexico that are physically boundaried to us. We're very sheltered, and we're not really encouraged, I don't think, in this country to take a more broad view of what is going on. We're just kind of innocent. And in a way, I kind of feel like it's not our fault. It's like a failure of the educational system. But I know that I've bumped into Europeans in Europe who are like, oh, Americans, yeah, you guys don't know shit. And we don't.
2 points on this. One is, I remember when I was in like later years, looking at reporting on 9/11, right? Like, we were talking about this on one of the anniversary days, right? And one of the things that kept coming up is like, Germany's, this was that headline, in France, this was that headline, in the UK, this was that headline. We didn't talk about how they covered it. They just showed us that these articles existed. We didn't talk about how different countries were analyzing the events happening here from a different perspective. And what a better event to look at than that, which had coverage from all over the world. On the other hand, as an American, I've been subscribed to different news organizations and lived all across the country. I've been in Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, Texas, New York, did I say California? Like, I've been all over. All the news is so East Coast centric. It's, you get some news out of New York, you get a lot of news out of DC, you'll get some news of like, if like there's a weird court case or a weird law or something in Florida or Texas or something like that, where there's a lot of people, and like fires in California, right? There's a whole middle of the country and we don't get any of that news of what's happening. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like as an American, it's not just that we don't know what's happening outside of our country. We don't know what's happening in our country.
Yeah.
And I think that's a part on both news media and our education system, is that we do not expand that view.
Yeah. And it's interesting, while we're talking about dystopia and whether or not we're actually living in one, whether that is by design or just by an unfortunate series of events. Certainly, if you spend any time watching news, no matter which way you lean politically, you're going to find people saying this isn't an accident. This is an agenda being worked. And that it comes out in our entertainment. You know, we can talk about horror for a minute. I wrote a lot of science fiction and horror when I was doing it in those days, and listened to a lot of panel discussions and lectures by famous people like John Carpenter talking about why is horror so popular. You look at your thumbnails as you scroll through Netflix, and there's no end of just schlock, horrible horror films that you're never even going to watch. But there's so much filler there. Somebody must be watching it. But why? Is it because we like the idea of being frightened in safety? Like, we can sit there and experience all the thrill without actually being in danger. And that there's something kind of inherently, it's like a caffeine jolt. It's like, woo, like a roller coaster ride. But I think it actually goes deeper than that. That, you know, it's a way for us to process the things that terrify us in our lives in a way that we're settled down. There's some more like theta waves. Are they the theta waves when you're going into like a hypnotic state? You know, when you're just letting this stuff wash over you, you have the opportunity to kind of think about it and experience it without actually having to have the stress of living in the middle of it and trying to make sense of it and cope with it. And I think dystopian literature does the same thing. I think it's a call to arms in a way, from the perspective of the authors. They're like, look, here's what can happen if we don't do something and do it soon. Because most dystopian literature takes place near future. And it was written because some author is alarmed by something that they see going on in society around them or in the world. And they are issuing a cautionary tale and a call to arms saying, look, there's a problem and we need to do something about it. That's not necessarily what the consumer is doing with that literature. They're taking it in and saying, yeah, I can relate, or, oh, you know, it's a good thing I don't live in that world, you know, one or the other. But in a way, we kind of do, you know. What do you think is the appeal for the dystopian genre?
Well, I think to your point about the writing, it's that Orwell wasn't writing about what he thought, like, he wasn't writing about the future, right? He was writing about the society in which he lived. Margaret Atwood was not writing about the future. She was writing about the society in which she lived. And I think it's twofold. And one is that there is a comfort in dystopian literature of, it is future, but it's not like, it's near future, but it's not right now. So there's that kind of comfort of like, we'll figure it out before then. Like, this is like a good, whatever, like a good,
there's still
story,
time.
But there's still time. We'll figure it out. It'll be fine. And I think there's kind of like that comfort of like, oh man, can you imagine? But then it's not. I think for others, it's also the appeal of seeing, I think that there is, and it's very common throughout horror and throughout thriller and throughout dystopia and all these other stories, where there is something very engaging about seeing characters pushed to the brink, like seeing them just on the edge of, or like actually just completely hopeless without choice, without whatever, and seeing what humans in that desperate situation will do, and the story of how characters grow or how they don't grow, and just how different people handle it. Because at the end of the day, they're all very human stories. So take 1984, and again, spoiler for a however many decades old book, there's the, they use their worst, the main two characters, they use their worst fears against them. And at the end, they see each other and they know that they both gave the other up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, there's something so dark and terrible and understandable about that.
Yeah. It's a place that, you can't come back from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I think people reading that, there is a part of you that says, I might not have done any different. Like, I think we all want to be that person who's like, I'm strong, I'm tough, I'm whatever. But like, if someone held a rat cage to my face and was like, we're going to let rats eat you alive unless you do, you do what we want. Listen, I don't want the rats to eat my face. Like,
yeah.
I'm aware of that. And I think there is something humanizing about that, of seeing characters struggle and make bad choices and what they do with those bad choices and whether or not they own those bad choices. To your point about horror, I think a lot of it is cathartic. I think horror can be very cathartic. And there was a beautiful book, and I highly recommend it, called My Heart is a Chainsaw by Stephen Graham Jones. And it's the idea of this girl, and she's, as she goes through the story, the main girl, Jade, dissects horror films and like, you kind of read it through her essays that she's writing to her high school teacher, her dissecting the idea of the final girl and the idea that you have a character who has gone through all of these horrible, horrible things and emerges stronger and able to defeat that villain at the end. And I think there's something very appealing in horror about seeing a character rise up, slaughter a monster, and rise victorious.
So now we're making the transition into film. We're talking about how a lot of the books that we just mentioned that were required reading in high school were very successfully turned into movies. And then there was a whole other crop of films that were never books. I'm thinking of, well, I think Blade Runner, I don't know if you remember a film in the 70s called Logan's Run. I think that both of those were books once. A Clockwork Orange was a book mm-hmm. before it was a movie. But then there's RoboCop, and I don't know if you've ever seen it, but at the time it was so cutting edge, but that was never a book, but it was a dystopian society where, you know, violence has it, uncontrolled violence in the streets is the name of the game. That happens a lot in dystopian literature. And the Matrix series as well, where we don't even know that we're not even living in the world that we're living in,
yeah.
Dystopian in nature. Hunger Games. They were books, weren't they? You know, yes, this is your generation now.
Yeah, and you're right. Blade Runner was a book by Philip K. Dick called New Android Stream of Electric Sheep.
Right.
And where there were a couple of really cool, I say cool, there were a couple of divergences between book and movie that were interesting choices. But yeah, that was a book by Philip K. Dick. And then Hunger Games was that whole trilogy. Yeah. And then there was Maze Runner that was a book series. Divergent was a book series. But yeah, there was a whole slew of YA dystopian things, but it was also kind of going off of the Harry Potter Chosen One idea. So you kind of had off of like this Harry Potter Chosen One, like you were born to do something. Also, like at the time, all the messaging we were getting is 90s and 2000s kids was like, kids are special and kids can do anything and blah, blah, blah. And then you had this book series of a boy wizard who was born to greatness and the power of love will save you. And kids coming off of that would then read, like, I read the Charlie Bone series, and that was the same, like, this kid is special and there's something like unique and he's destined for things. And you had Hunger Games, which is like this girl rises up, and you had Divergent, and even to an extent The Giver, I would say is I would call that a dystopian story for sure. And there is very much like a chosen one thing in there too. And I think that kind of fed into, okay, so you're going to have a chosen one safe society. So society has to be broken. How do we make society broken? Oh, it's dystopian. But how is it dystopian this way, in a way that was different from this series, that was different than this series? So he ended up with a bunch of stories that were all chaos, government, kids overthrowing
the world. But it sounds like what you're saying, and again, I punched out before that whole subgenre of young adult dystopian literature had its rise to popularity. So your wisdom here is valuable to me in this conversation. It sounds like you're saying that the dystopia is being used as a device to facilitate what sounds like a classic, like Greek mythological hero's journey, or even like a King Arthur kind. Only one person can pull that sword out of the stone and you're destined for this. And so the dystopia is a device that kind of undergirds a different agenda than the literature that we were talking about before. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way to summarize my very long-winded train of thought. I think The Hunger Games did have more of a point about it. Like, it did have a commentary associated, but I think a lot of the time when you have these books that get really popular, right? So like, take Twilight, say what you will, it got really popular. All of a sudden we had vampire romance book after vampire romance book after vampire romance book. And then from there it was, oh, well, people don't like vampires anymore. Werewolf romance, whatever. So,
well, let's put them both together in one movie.
Yeah, that's fine. And I think you have something that like sells. And so then all the publishers want that thing that sold. So you had Hunger Games that had this, some sort of commentary to it, but was at the end of the day, a girl saved the world. And then you had all these other YA stories off the back of that, that got popular off the back of that, that might not have had as much of a social commentary as they were a device to tell the hero's journey story. So I think the one thing that really unites all of them, and when I was working on my book, this was something that really bothered me. And I should have just been reading adult literature when I was trying to compare it. But because it's YA, certain genres have certain rules that they have to follow, right? So if you're writing a romance book, it has to be that the two characters get married, end of story, happily ever after. Like, that's the romance thing. Most of the time, it has to also be one true happy ending and no one cheats. If you cheat and then do whatever, like, you've gone against the rules of the genre and your book will be yelled at for eternity.
Right.
One of the main things about YA is that you have to explore death as a periphery. You explore grief as a periphery. So Hunger Games did a good job of that within the, but you also had it within the realms of, it's a game, like the first book was like, this is a game where we fight to the death, right? But then they tie and they're like, no, we're going to tie the game. And at the end of the story, the main character is alive and probably has some complex PTSD, but the society has crumbled and everything's fine. And now we're in a utopia and democracy wins. Like, however that ended, like, I don't know if you ever watched the movie, but the end of the last movie is basically the leader is killed, like the main president head honcho dude is killed. And then all of a sudden, she's just fine in a field with her husband, happy. And it's like, yeah, I just skipped a couple steps there. But
yeah,
cool.
That's
story.
Like in The Princess Bride, the wedding scene where the priest is taking too long to deliver the ceremony. He's like, skip to the end.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think that that's a big thing in YA. And I think that's partially why it fits a hero's journey really well, but also to the detriment of having a really good societal commentary. And I think the books had a little bit more explanation, but they didn't go through the political process of like, okay, now she's okay now, right? I think the most egregious one was, hang on, I got to find the name of it. I wrote it down. It was called Article 5. The Article 5 series was, this girl just decides she's going to be the poster child because having children out of wedlock is now illegal. And she was a child out of wedlock and she marries a cop and there's not really a romance triangle. It's just her with a cop. And then the end of the book is literally the end of the series, right? They've overthrown the government. They're on a boat. They row the boat to shore and they're like, we're in Florida and life is great. And that's literally how it ends. And
I'm like, going to Disneyland. Wow.
Wow. And I get it because it's the rule of the genre, but like, I just don't buy it as an actual dystopian if you're using it as the framing device of romance happily ever after. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I know that there was kind of a distinct point in cinematic history where sympathetic villains became a thing. Like, we were tired of knowing the end game before the opening credits were done. And so this started to emerge where we started to actually root for the bad guy. And sometimes the bad guy would win, or alternatively, things that were not maybe superhero, villain, hero oriented, just films where the endings were not happy. And that was a satisfying thing. Like, we were fed up with Happily Ever After. Mm-hmm. And we wanted, what was the movie? Was it 7 where Brad Pitt is like, what's in the box at the end? And,
yeah.
I mean, that's not a happy ending.
It's not a happy ending. I love that movie. But yeah. I think It's what are you coming to the media for? What are you coming to the story, this book, this film, TV show, whatever? What is your intention at the end of it? Because I can tell you, when I'm rewatching Gilmore Girls for the 20th time, I'm not going to that to be anything less than I know the story. I know how it ends. I'm happy with that, right? Like I'm good with like there's journey along the way, there's character development along the way, but it's at the end of the day, it's happy. If I'm picking up, so I'm reading right, I just finished another book by Eric LaRocca and he writes body horror short stories. I'm not going to Eric LaRocca to feel good about that at the end of that, you know? Yeah. And so I feel like when you're, and I feel like it gets really confusing when you have dystopian that, and again, I understand the rules of YA are different than the rules of adult fiction, but traditionally, writers have gone into thrillers, into horror, into whatever, to kind of say something, to have a point. And I question if you're not willing to tackle the dark parts associated with that. If you're writing a story set in a horrifying time and you're not willing to really engage in the horrifying things because you know your audience just wants a happy ending. So you're not willing to talk about why are the people in, just for like an example, right? Like, why are the people in government doing what they, what doing what they're doing? Why is everyone just like following along with the rule? Are you talking about the fear associated with that? Are they just all sadists? Have they just like come up with a screening process to be like, you like giving pain? We're sending you to do the interrogations.
Yeah. Have they been drugged into submission? Have they been oppressed into submission? Yeah.
And then are you willing to engage with your character experiencing fear and having me as the reader really concerned about how this is going to end? So say what you will about George R. R. Martin and the speed of his writing, the fact that he was willing to kill Robinette, he killed the father and then he killed the son. And then it's, okay, so what happens after that? Now anyone that you thought, that you immediately thought would solve this problem is not around to solve the problem. So what do you do? And that chaos is such a good breeding ground for a story, yeah, right? And I want to question it. But I'm not picking up a Daniel Steele book and being like, I'm concerned that the main character might die. Like, that's not, you go to literature for different things. And I feel like when you kind of conflate those two, it runs the risk of reducing the power of the genre.
And if you read across genres, like some people only read in a preferred genre, and I certainly have always preferred science fiction and horror literature all my life, but I do read in other genres. And if it's fiction, it's not really about, for me, is it going to have a happy ending or is it going to explore weighty issues? Does it have this or that element to it? For me, it's about, is it a satisfying experience? When I get to that last page, do I close the book and go, I'm satisfied with what I've just invested my time in? Or if I'm left hanging, or if something major like didn't get answered or addressed, or if I just feel that the author got lazy in the third act and just wasn't trying anymore, and I can perceive that as I'm nearing the end, what I want is to be holding a book in my hand and to see that I only have 25 pages left and to start feeling melancholy. Like, oh no, this is about to end. I'm having a good time in here. You know, I don't want to go home. And if it doesn't deliver that, then I'm unhappy with it, regardless of the genre. Whatever you're doing, please do it well or don't bother. Yeah. So,
and I feel like with dystopian, with horror, with thriller, I have some of my favorite books, some of the ones that have destroyed me, have left me at the end feeling hollow, but that if the author had written one more word, it would have been too much. Like sometimes that emptiness, that hanging, that questioning is how that story
is satisfying.
Needed to end. And that is satisfying in a way that's like, I'm deeply not satisfied.
Yeah. But, you know, because like, it's by design and not out of laziness. You were talking about Philip K. Dick earlier. The Man in the High Castle was recently done as a Netflix series. Did you happen to plug into that?
Didn't read it or watch it. Honestly, did not know that was a Philip K. Dick book. I'm really behind on him.
Yeah, it was like a full-on novel, and it was made into a Netflix series. I think there were eight or ten parts, and it falls into the genre of alternate history, which I think is a great vehicle, you know, for exploring ideas like this. And it's definitely a dystopian society. And what has happened is we didn't win the Second World War. The Germans and the Japanese did. And what does New York look like today, being run by the Nazi Party and the Yakuza, and how do those two factions, what's the tension between them in terms of power struggles and all of that? And what does the society look like? And it's very oppressive, and you dare not step out of line. And then there's a man in the high castle who has some film reels that show a different outcome. So he has films of an alternate reality where it didn't go that way, and that is dangerous. So I would look that up if you hadn't.
Yeah, that sounds really good.
Very, very interesting. And Philip K. Dick was out of his freaking mind, that guy. So you have to kind of step outside yourself in order to even wrap your head around the way that he writes. He's not an easy guy to read.
No, he's not. There were two other ones that have come out recently, and there was, I think it was Philip Roth wrote this book, but it was if Charles Lindbergh won the presidency and was a Nazi.
Wow.
Was one telling. And then the other one was, it came out on Apple TV, and it's if the Soviets got to the moon before we did, what would have happened?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting, because what I really appreciate about that one is it's not necessarily just like doom and gloom and totalitarian and the Russians won and everything else. It's not about that. It's how would we have changed how we did things? How would they have changed how they did things? Like, one of the best parts of that series, I think, was that they put more diversity into it. And it was, how do we get the best and brightest talent on both sides? So they end up recruiting more women. They end up recruiting more women of color. And whether or not that would have been historically accurate is a question, but it's an interesting question of like, if we didn't just succeed doing what we'd already done, what would we have changed? And would that have potentially been a good thing?
Yeah. You know? That whole alternate history genre is just a goldmine of thought experiments. It's a very interesting thing to ask those what if questions.
Mm-hmm.
I want to shift gears for a second, and let's talk about your book. It's your debut novel. It's called The Next Witness. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier that it was kind of a labor of love that's been with you through your own personal development. Tell us a little bit, if you would, about what it's about. And is it dystopian in nature?
It is absolutely dystopian. It is a dystopian thriller. Melody is a daughter of, she's a party kid. And in this society, everyone who is born into the party is automatically not just a party member, but is required to enter the same branch of government as their parents. So her father is a judge, so it is expected that she joins judiciary. She does not, and this immediately, like, she's always kind of under this suspicious lens. So at one point, her apartment is searched, and she is found to have what they call anti-government material, and she goes on the run. And then the second point of view is Detective Alexander Covington, who is tasked with finding her. And the third point of view is Derek Lynn, who was kind of affiliated by proxy with Melody and with Covington's junior, Detective Logan Madden, and kind of realizes what the propaganda was that they found out about her, and realizes that one of his best friends has been killed in the effort to find her. So in his anger, he builds a movement around her just out of a need to do something, because he just like can't deal with the fact that his friends died. And he's Logan kind of convinces him and is like, you can't use your friend's name because no one knows he's dead, but people know that there's an investigation to find this girl. So when Melody finds out, she comes back to try to dissuade him from continuing on this journey, being like, you're letting people die. I didn't say this was okay. And meanwhile, the government's like, she's leading a revolution. And she's like, I had nothing to do with this. Oh, wow. Why? What are you doing? And it's not a happy story, as we've been discussing. I hope it leaves people with that kind of hollow feeling. And most of the reviews so far, actually, I think all of the reviews so far have mentioned the ending. Even like a negative one was like, the ending was horrible. And everyone else was like, the ending was horrible. Why did you do that to me? So I think it did what I wanted it to do in that regard. But yeah, it's I think that's a decent summary without giving too much.
So since we were talking about authors creating works of dystopian literature coming out of a response to a current geopolitical issue or a societal problem, and it being a cautionary tale or a call to action, if you started writing this book at 15, I'm guessing that really wasn't your catalyst. What was?
So I'm going to kind of compare it to the work I did for my master's thesis, which was UK forecasting 2017 to 2027 post-Brexit. And this was very much in a vacuum. But while doing that research, I was looking at the drivers of UK policy and everything from economic to societal pressures to xenophobia and just how intertwined they were with the EU and how that would look like broken away in varying degrees of severity. So much like you're talking about the alternative history, it was basically like writing a mini short story on three ways that society could look over the next 10 years. And for me, my process of, I guess, unintentionally, the process of writing this book was very similar in the fact that as I was growing up and I'm looking at all the, and like I'm studying politics and I'm studying international affairs and everything else and just becoming a human, looking at all the drivers kind of US society and turning that into a story of, well, how does this look? How does it present itself? Right. So from everything from Derek needs to use the blonde, blue-eyed girl to be his poster child and not his friend, as well as, okay, so how does it look when we take we take our nepotism in society to an extreme degree and turn it into like government policy? And just like the idea that, so like the Bush family, right? Like you had Senior, you had Junior, you had Jed try to run for president and he was the former governor of Florida, like all this, these like political families, right? And kind of turning those ideas into what does that look like if implemented into law? And what does that do to the rest of society? What does that do in terms of law enforcement? And what if ICE wasn't meant to keep people out? It was to keep people in, and everything in between. And obviously that doesn't all, like my entire brain process doesn't show on the paper, but I think it was kind of an evolution of that thought of, if we take these ideas to an extreme, what does that look like?
Because every 15-year-old is in their bedroom with their earbuds in thinking about this stuff.
Well, you know, it changed quite a few times, though, about why.
Sure.
So originally when I was putting it together, I thought it would be a nuclear war, which I think is very common for dystopian novels, is for there to have been like a massive, massive war. And I changed it. So it's not an external war. It was an internal war. It was a civil war in like the starting in around like the 2030s of not red versus blue states or anything like that, but it was literally like your neighbor could attack you. Like it was very Syrian like in nature of just all these different factions. No one knows really what's going on, or like not even Syrian, but kind of those like kind of taking the idea of that level of uncertainty with some of the politics of like Soviet era states combined. So looking at what comes of a society where you can't trust your next door neighbor, you can't trust your child, you can't trust anybody, and just the bleakness and the kind of desperation for human contact that comes from that.
So that reminds me of The Purge, the recent films along those lines where, all bets are off for, what is it, one day a year? I've actually never seen the films, but because the concept was so terrifying, it's like, I'm not going to sit down for 2 hours with this.
It's like, I have no doubt that that film is well done, but I have also no doubt that that film is scary accurate.
Yeah,
to what could happen. And
I looked at the title and the synopsis and said, no. And then they did it a second time. I think there was a sequel to it.
There was a third one. I think they are up to three or four.
Oh, it needs to stop. I'm making that judgment without any information whatsoever.
They'll stop the Purge movies when they stop the Saw movies.
Are they still going on?
I thought they were. They made like nine. So
I thought they were finished.
We still got at least three more Purges to go.
Also a series that I've not watched. It was during my I don't think I'm going to do horror anymore years. So I might have to catch up with them, but I don't know.
Apparently
I made it through 11 seasons of The Walking Dead. And my brother convinced me to watch. I didn't start plugging in until I think season 7, he convinced me I should watch it because it's really not about zombies. It's about a post-apocalyptic world where people are trying to survive and to rebuild society and how that looks for all of the different communities that our little band of central characters are encountering through the years. So I said, okay, I'll sit down and watch it. I watched the first episode and I said, well, that's interesting. And then the very second episode was every episode has a title. And the second episode was titled Guts. And we introduced the concept that in order to safely move among the zombies, you just have to open one up and cover yourself with their guts. And then they can't recognize you. It was the most disgusting thing I think I'd ever seen on television. I had no warning that it was happening. And I complained to my brother bitterly afterward. I said, how am I going to make it to episode three after that.
Yeah.
And he promised and said, no, stick with it. And I ended up not only watching every episode, but all the spinoff series as well, and surprised myself, honestly. After the first season, you almost don't even see the zombies anymore. You become so, it becomes background noise. And it becomes, you've seen so much of the screen gore, the CGI gore, that you just don't even, they don't, you can see them harden to it. You know, oh, here comes another zombie, got to kill him, you know, moving on. And it gets that casual because your focus does shift to the central characters and what they're trying to accomplish in this whole new world.
Yeah.
And you're thinking as you go, like, oh gosh, here they are. They've gone into an abandoned building. And in order to survive, they need to drink water that's been in a toilet tank for a year and a half, you know, because it's their only source of water. Or what are they going to do when they've looted, you know, every possible shop and all the canned goods are gone and everything is gone? Now, what do we do? What do we do without, you know, work animals and we can't grow anything? You know, what are we going to do? I think at one point they break into a library to steal their seeds that had been stored in some DNA library or something.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, a lot of interesting concepts. And then all the different factions that they run into and everybody's idea about what society needs to, oh, we're starting over. It's just us. Okay, this is what it's going to look like. And it's different every single time, except the leader is always corrupt. And it always is going to have to, you know, go down in a giant battle.
Another part that comes up, and you see it in Girl with All the Gifts, and you see it in a book called Severance by Ling Ma, and you see it in other things, is who is, like, just say that happened tomorrow, right? Like, all of a sudden, everything's gone. Whoever in that situation has existed in 2023, all their creature comforts are also gone, and just decides, I know what I'm doing. I know what's best for everybody. I'm clear, like, clearly this is it. No, I automatically don't trust you. And it's the scary thing of people being desperate for an answer, being desperate for security. And that comes up in everything, thriller, dystopian, horror, whatever. Yeah. Just people being so needing of an answer that they go to the first person that says, I have an answer.
Right. They're willing to line up behind that and authority figure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And are willing to ignore every problematic thing that comes after because they just want to be safe. And I think zombie things in particular are a brilliant way of exploring that facet of human identity and that need for security and need for community.
Yeah. One of the things that I actually appreciated about the Walking Dead series and the showrunners and the writers of the original graphic novel series came out and said that they intentionally did not explore the origin or the pursuit of a cure at all, because they didn't want it to go into science fiction. They wanted it to be horror, and they didn't want it to be about why. They wanted it to be about the people, the survivors, and what they were going to do. It really isn't about zombies. And I thought that was a very interesting angle to take. In addition, what you were just saying is the people who were alive before the zombie apocalypse are the ones that are creating all of these new societies, these walled cities that are tightly controlled, not just to protect them against the zombies, but to protect them against other survivors. Mm-hmm. But now, after 11 seasons, you have a generation of babies that were born after the apocalypse who are now coming into their own. And the suggestion is, these are the people that are going to take us into the next era of human existence. They don't know a world before. And that's an interesting thing to explore as well.
That was one of my favorite parts of The Girl with All the Gifts, is exploring that idea of what happens after.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, because we were talking about like genre tropes and like using those devices to tell a story. And I really think the strongest zombie stories have nothing to do with zombies. I think this the best, what we've been talking about the entire time, which is like human nature and what people will do and push into a corner and what they're doing when they're searching for safety. And I think the best storytellers are able to tell that story, are able to tell tales of human suffering, human struggles, human trials, and present it in a very realistic way, even if in a very unrealistic scenario. So I think having those kinds of devices, having those types of backgrounds is really helpful.
Yes.
For those kinds of things.
Yeah. You know, as is going to happen with you and I, if somebody is not paying attention and corralling us, we're going to meander, because we were talking about your novel and then boom, we went down the road
of
film
yeah.
again. I wanted to ask you what kind of reception your book is getting and if there is something else in the works. And then we just start talking about film again. So let me try to bring it back to that and ask you about that.
Sure. Yeah, real quick. So the reviews have been pretty positive. And like I said, even the one negative comment was like, I very firmly believe that it was just someone who didn't know what they were getting into, which very fair.
But read every the book review, by accident.
Yeah, every review has mentioned the ending, which is what I really wanted. I wanted that ending to be impactful. So for me, that's a success. In terms of another one in the works, not anything in this series, but I have been working on a magical realism story, which will be slightly happier, she says, with asterisks all around. But that's not really going to be dystopian. That's just, I'm going to call it, I think right now I'm calling it magical realism. And it's going to be a little bit outside of my wheelhouse of, because normally I write just thriller and horror, like horror short stories and that kind of thing. And this is going to like, it's, I would say it's a thriller, but it'll have brief moments of hope, which is new for me.
What state of development is it in at this point?
It's about 35,000 words in.
That's intriguing.
So
I'll want you to keep us posted about that one.
Yeah, I have good feelings about it. I think by the time that it's done, it'll be pretty strong. Assuming I get it done. I keep getting distracted. So like, if I start out the week being like, oh, I want like a word count, which is never a good goal for me, but I'll do that. And then I'll end up just like seeing a deadline for a short story submission. So I think I've actually written like 20,000 words this calendar year. Not all of that. Like I would say 5% has been the novel. The other half has been short stories and short things. So, but it's kind of nice to like break it up in this and just like, I need to let my brain, because I have ADHD, and I kind of just need to let my brain, if it gets an idea, just to like let that idea go. And then when I want to focus back on the book, then I can focus back on the book versus being like, I wish I was writing something else right now, because then I just end up being frustrated.
Yeah, I get that. Where can The Next Witness be purchased? Is it available on Amazon? I know you gave me a link tree that I'm going to put in the show notes. Will that take our audience to a place where they can purchase it if they're interested in reading?
Yes. Thank you so much for that. So you can get it from Amazon, BarnesandNoble, bookshop.org, most indie stores. If you have like a favorite local store where you live, they can usually, or you can order it through their website usually. And on eBooks, it's on Apple Books, it's on Kindle, it's on I think it's on Kobo, it's on Nook, it's on all the things. So yeah, basically if you go into a physical Barnes and Noble, they might not have it, but they can definitely get it for you.
And your podcast, Dark Waters, the literary podcast exploring all that is dark, dreary, and wonderfully twisted, can we find that on most popular podcast platforms?
Yeah, that's also a link to that is in the link tree too. So if people want to listen to that, but that's on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, the usual suspects. You can find it there too.
And is it interview based or is it you talking about literature? What's the format?
Most of the time it's interviews. It's me and my co-host, Nate, who's another writer, great, talented dude, writes more crime and noir. And then we will usually interview an author, either about their work in progress or a new release or something, just something that they want to talk about.
Very cool. I'm going to let you go about your day for today. Yeah. I think if we don't do that, we could talk forever, you and I, and we're going to leave our audience in the dust because we have too much to say. So when your second book is finished, I would love for you to come back and talk about that one. Magical realism sounds fantastic to me.
I will tease you. It is called Poison the Well.
Okay. When can we expect it to be finished? We don't know that, do we?
I hope by the end of the year. My goal is to have it done before my 30th birthday. That's, I think, a decently attainable goal, to have the second manuscript done before my 30th birthday.
I would love to celebrate that with you. Hit me up and I will welcome you back to talk about it and promote it for sure. Thank
Sounds
you for
great.
A great conversation, Kirsten. I'm really pleased that we had a chance to get together, and I hope that we do it again super soon.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was great. It's great talking to you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. I think the camaraderie and the mutual joy at being able to nerd out with each other probably came through in that conversation, and I'm totally happy about it. I want to just make you aware of a listener survey that's available on my website, coolgraystudios.com. If you click on the podcast menu option, you'll find a podcast listener survey, especially if you've been listening all along. But even if today is your first episode, I would love it if you would pop over there and take about 5 minutes to complete that. Also, under that podcast menu option, there's another place where you can fill out a form if you'd like to be considered to be a guest on this podcast. So if you've listened enough to know that we're trying to have interesting conversations with interesting people about a wide variety of topics in hopes of stimulating deeper thought, if that sounds like you and you want to engage on that level, or you know somebody that you think would make a great guest, I'm inviting you to point them toward that page and go ahead and complete that form, and I'll get in touch and we'll see if there's something we might be able to do together. My parting thought today, I think, is kind of in keeping with the theme of the conversation that we had. It's a little poem by Wendell Berry, and it's called The Peace of Wild Things. So while we're thinking about what it would be like if we could live in a utopia, which doesn't exist, maybe we should try to look for the best in what we actually have around us. And so to that end, here's today's parting thought. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives might be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in its beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world, and I am free. I'm just going to let that sit right there and marinate with you for the remainder of the day. Please come back in 2 weeks for my amazing conversation with Kathleen Martin about her aunt and uncle, Betty and Barney Hill, who were the first U.S. couple ever to claim to have been abducted by aliens, which set their entire family on a lifelong journey. So it's a great conversation. I'm very excited about bringing it to you, and I hope I see you then. Meanwhile, I'd like to say thanks for listening. Come on back, and I will see you next time. Cool Gray and Studio A is a fine-tuned services production. It exists for entertainment purposes and is not intended to be used as a sole source of information or advice on any subject. Find and follow this podcast at coolgraystudios.com.